He has my passport in his hand. I am escorted to a red plastic bench. And I thought, I'm going to end up in the Shazi prison. And my crime is purple hair.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Welcome to episode 42 of Cold War Conversations. Gillian Cox visited the GDR as a student in October 1989, just before the wall came down. In this episode, you will hear her eyewitness account of what she saw in East Germany on the cusp of its destruction. Before we start the episode, I wanted to thank everyone who's supporting the podcast financially via Patreon and one-off donations. This includes our latest supporters, William Wallace, Peter Ryan, George Foster, and James Chilcott. Now, some of you may not realize that this podcast is a one-man band, and the podcast is financed out of my own pocket. When I started this in March 2018, I had no idea how popular this was going to be and have been astonished by the interest, your feedback and the generosity of my guests in allowing me to share their stories. Now, this popularity does increase the costs of putting the podcast out, and if all of our listeners paid just a dollar or a pound or a euro a month, I'd be able to do far more. Now, you may wonder, what is this Patreon thing I keep banging on about? Well, it just makes it dead easy to support the podcast. Just visit patreon.com/coldwarpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. So that's patreon.com/coldwarpod. Just choose your level of support, and then I will receive that amount monthly. In addition, you'll get access to previews and other exclusive extras that don't make it into the free version of the show. So just click patreon.com/coldwarpod. So enough of that. Now back to today's episode. We start off with Gillian describing her interest in the Cold War and how she ended up in the GDR. We welcome Gillian Cox. You went on a tour of the Eastern Bloc in 1989. How did that come about?
I had applied, I believe it was January or February of 1989, to do a semester abroad. It was through the School of International Training, which I believe was at Brattleboro, Vermont. I was at Boston University at that time, and they had a program in Berlin. So I thought, all right, nothing ventured in all that. They asked for, I'd say, an essay about why I'm interested in the program, a few other bits and pieces, and I thought, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I would have to say they wanted a certain GPA, which I had, and I think it was around about the time of spring vacation when I was back down in Miami to see my parents, that I got the phone call, you're in. And so I immediately went ahead, got my passport, found out about, I'd say, changing all of my money into Deutschmark traveler's checks, which, of course, was quite amusing. And everything else that I had to do in order to prepare for the semester abroad.
And right. And how old were you then?
I was 19. And I have to say, my father was all for it. My mother was a little bit intrepid. I'm an only child. And she said, are you sure you're ready for this? And I said, I'm fine with it, Mom. Of course, what she did not know was that I was like, wait a minute, I'm actually going to do this? Because it had been, of course, in the back of my mind. Oh, sure, yes, go to Berlin, a zillion miles away, no problem. And then when the acceptance letter came, it was, oh, this is real now. Wow. So.
And did they know that you were crossing into the Eastern Bloc as well?
My father knew. I think my mother had an idea because she knew that part of the program was going to be in Poland. But what she did not know was that probably I was going to end up spending about a week in the day-to-day air, and that there would probably be some side trips, you know, a few little day trips into East Berlin. And I think that that probably would have frightened her half to death at that point. She would have been like, oh, no. And I thought, this is going to be interesting. Going to the day-to-day air.
Yeah. How did you get to West Berlin? Did you fly into London or Frankfurt?
Actually, as a group, we flew into Brussels from New York's JFK airport. And then we got on a train in Brussels that I believe it brought us to the area around Cologne. We stayed in Cologne for a day or two. I believe we went to Bonn to explore the SPD and CDU headquarters. We also went to a wonderful art museum, the name of which escapes me. It had a lot of modern art from the Bauhaus era onward. And, of course, the cathedral at Cologne. Beautiful. And I'd say that probably my recollections of that are not terribly great because I was fighting jet lag and there just wasn't enough coffee.
Was it the first time you'd been outside the US?
No, actually, the first time I went outside of the US, I was 6 years old when my parents and I went to Grand Cayman. And so it was my second time.
Okay. But the first time on your own and at that distance?
Oh, definitely. First time on my own.
So you're in Cologne. What happens next?
Well, we got on a train in Cologne after a day or two, and then we ended up in West Berlin for about, I'd say, first 4 or 5 days. We stayed at the West Berlin headquarters of the School for International Training just so that we could acclimate to Berlin. We took some.
Okay. And how did you cross into West Berlin? Did you go through Helmstadt and then train from there?
I'm trying to remember. I recall that once we got to East Germany, we all had to fork over our passports, get those stamped. And then we took the train straight on through and then into West Berlin. And I believe we got off the train proper at, I want to say Wannsee, because it was close to Grunewald.
Right.
And that was where the West Berlin headquarters, School for International Training, was. And we spent about 4 days there.
Okay. And did you go into West Berlin from there, or were you there? You were there for the 4 days just doing courses and things like that?
I know that I went exploring because I wanted to hit the ground running. Not so sure about some of the others because they were, I'd say, more of a tightly knit little bunch. I really wasn't. I was sort of that lone wolf who had to say, I wonder what's over there. Let me go see.
Yeah. So you went on your own into West Berlin. How did you find West Berlin initially?
I fell in love instantly. Everything was, you know, just completely, it was new. It was different. Okay, my German wasn't terribly great, but I realized, okay, between my broken German and their broken English, we can make this work. I found the public transport system extremely simple, very well organized, and very clean, as opposed to Boston's, which is simple but filthy. And I also found that if you tried speaking German, generally speaking, people were friendly. If you fumbled, they figured, okay, she fumbles, we fix, we make this work. So I just immediately latched on to everything. And as I said, about 4 days later, I met up with my host family. And for lack of a better one, they allowed me, I'd say, the same level of freedom to go ahead, do what I needed, what I wanted, as you would expect. I'd say, even here in the States, it's like, you're 19, go ahead, explore. And besides, you're here to learn anyway. And they respected that.
And when you first went into Berlin during those 4 days, where did you go into? Did you just head straight for the center, the Coup d'Arme, and round there?
I started out just heading straight in for obviously Kafestendam, some of the areas along the wall that were, I'd say, closer to Brandenburg Gate and Reichstag.
When you first saw the wall, did it live up to the expectation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was jarring because you're wandering along. I mean, there I was, somewhat naive American kid, suddenly let loose in a foreign country, and I'm just wandering along. Beautiful day outside because we're talking early September in Berlin. Not hot and also not too cold. And I thought, all right, this is perfect. And it was the case of all roads led east and stopped. Boom, there you are. And it's, oh, yes, you are now leaving the American sector. Wow. And so that really, I'd say, sort of gave me that jolt of, all right, this is the border that people cannot cross to come in. I can go there. They can't come here. And of course, at that point, I had also been reading about the fact that certain things were going on in East Germany. I'd read about some of the protests that had been happening in Leipzig and Dresden in East Berlin, as well as the people who were getting out via Hungary. And so I knew even then something is afoot, something is changing. And it's not the people, say, at the high government level. It's the people who were, I'd say, my age and a little bit older, who were doing, you know, who were holding all of the demonstrations and all of, I'd say, the other protests, saying, look, we are the people and we want to go ahead and live our lives.
Yeah. So you're staying with this host family in West Berlin. And where were they? Where did they live?
They were in the Steglitz area. I'd say it looked like virtually any other suburb. Beautiful house. And the family themselves, Kozlovskis, they were lovely people. Their oldest, Zilke, was actually in the United States staying with an American family, I think in either Illinois or Iowa. Can't remember. But their two younger children, both boys, Jens, I think, was 13 at the time, and Jörg was 10. So basically, Jens, because he was 13, he was so unimpressed by everything, including me. I was just another horrible big sister. You know, it's like, oh, please, we don't want her hanging around. Jörg was rather intrigued by me because, well, he was only 10, and he thought, oh, okay, cool. Somebody else to go ahead and maybe hang out with for a minute. So periodically, he was my little sidekick.
And what did the Kozlovskis say about the East? Did they talk to you about East Berlin at all?
Actually, my host father, Dirk, he was born in East Germany. And so he had quite a bit to say about things that were wrong with East Germany, because I think that he and his family had managed to get out of there right under the wire in terms of when the division became complete and the wall was up and all of that. And however, Gerda, my host mom, I think she was a lifelong West Berliner. And so she was also like, well, they need to change things in East Germany. People are speaking, so it's obvious.
Yeah, yeah. And when did you first cross into East Berlin?
First time I crossed into East Berlin, I think it was after we had been in West Berlin for about a week or two. And I remember changing the money, walking through, I think we went through Friedrichstrasse, and you're coming away from West Berlin, which is all bright lights, everybody busy out on the street, everybody running around all the time, things going at a very quick pace, and then, boom, you're in East Berlin. These wide, wide streets with nobody on them. this mishmash of architecture, which is all of the old world heavy Germanic architecture mixed with Soviet architecture. And it made quite the mishmash, particularly around Alexanderplatz. And again, fewer people. And then it was, oh, and now I see this horrible little green car. That thing sounds like a lawnmower, for goodness sake. Oh, it's a Trabant.
I'd watch it, Gillian. There's some big fans of the Trabant who listen to this podcast. But carry on.
No, I understand. because my first encounter with it was, oh my goodness, this car. And then, of course, encountering Wartburgs and the occasional Lada and saying, I don't know if there are any traffic jams around here. I wonder what an East German traffic jam would look like. on several occasions on that first trip, I remember going into shops thinking, well, I've got to get rid of this 25 Ostmark, and there's nothing to buy. So I remember going into a stationer's shop and picked up a pad of paper because I thought, can't go wrong with a pad of paper. And I bought a handful of pens because pens were cheap. We get outside the shop. I start trying to get one of the pens to actually start writing. Of, I think, the 12 pens that I bought, one of them wrote.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And I thought, okay, the quality of goods, non-existent. All right, note to self, do not buy East German pens. And when I tried to write on the paper that I bought with, say, a regular ink gel pen or anything else that was resemblant thereof, that, of course, I picked up either in the States or in West Germany at some point, it bled straight through. And I thought, wow, even the paper is bad. This isn't good. How in the world do they deal with this? Low quality. And so that was really, again, one of those, I'd say, peculiar experiences that really stuck with me was, okay, how do they manage to make it work over here at all?
Yeah, yeah. And did you, what, so you really just did the center area, Alexanderplatz, Unter den Linden, and around there, yeah?
Right.
On that first trip.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't until the second trip that I really had a bit of an adventure, but that, of course, was all precipitated by the fact that I got stuck at the border crossing. Probably had something to do with the fact that my hair was dyed purple.
Yeah, I've heard they weren't keen on that sort of style. But anyway, carry on, Gillian.
They really weren't, because I was also wearing a black leather jacket. It had gotten a bit colder in the intervening weeks. This was late September. Yes, September 28th, to be exact, 6 weeks exactly before the wall fell. And remember, we got to the little booth at the border crossing at Friedrichstrasse, gave my passport, gave my 5 Deutschmark coins so that I could get the visa. And standing there, a little booth, the Volkspolizei was looking me up, down, up, down. And I thought, this is taking a little bit too long. And, of course, the back of my head, I was panicking. I thought, oh, my God, what in the world's going on here? He picks up the receiver on this horrible green telephone says something that I couldn't quite decipher, takes my, you know, kicks the five-mark coin back to me. He has my passport in his hand. I am escorted to a red plastic bench. I thought, okay, my life is over. Because I, of course, had done an absolute load of reading about East Berlin, East Germany, and occasionally the Stasi prison previous summer before going over. And I thought, all right, I'm going to end up in the Stasi prison. And my crime is purple hair. All right, my crime is purple hair.
And the leather jacket. So, don't forget that.
And the leather jacket. My crimes were purple hair and a leather jacket. And I thought, oh, this is not good. I mean, everything that I knew in German just exited my head. I could not remember my father's telephone number at his office because it had recently switched. I could barely remember my mother's work telephone number. And I thought, okay, do I get a phone call? Or, and then I thought, no. This is not an American crime movie. This is not an American crime drama. This is an East German drama. You don't get a phone call. You don't get an attorney. And so I sat there for 45 minutes, sweating. And I thought, all right, if I make it out of here in one piece, I will be eternally grateful. Well, after the longest 45 minutes of my life, a couple of East German Volkspolizei come back. One of them hands me my passport. The other one hands me another piece of paper that looked like the beginnings of a transit visa. I was told to stand in another line, and I was assured that I would get through. Of course, at that point, I was absolutely terrified. I thought, okay, I just have to make it across the border. Well, that time, I made it. Stepped outside of the Friedrichstrasse station. And again, it was a beautiful day. Absolutely gorgeous weather. So I start walking, and I thought, well, first thing I need to do is sit down and just sort of recollect myself for a moment. Found this strange little cafe where everything in there was that horrible shade of sort of mint green. I thought, okay, I'll take it, as long as they have coffee. And sat there, drinking my coffee. At that point, I smoked. So, lit up a cigarette, sitting there, drinking my coffee, smoking my cigarette. And I noticed there was a man two seats behind me, writing. And I thought, okay, how do I lose this guy? Because I have this horrible feeling. Got up. He got up like 5 seconds after I did. I started walking. He started following me. This went on for what I felt like forever. I must have played the cat and mouse game of I go here, he follows. I go here, he follows. For, I'd say, a good hour and a half, maybe longer. I lost track of time because I was just trying to figure out a way to lose this guy. It was scary. I finally dove down this side street. Could not tell you the name of it right now because 29 years does funny things to your memory. Walked into this little bar and I guess you could say dumb luck and a kind bartender all intervened. I walk up to the bar. I reached into the pocket of my leather jacket. And I think I produced a $10 bill. Put that on the counter. Barman, because, well, I'd say he's probably about the same age I was, 19, 20 years old. He produces the bottle of Stolichnaya. And I said, you know, in between broken German and broken English, I said, how much will $10 buy? At that point, I'd probably have to say it was mid-afternoon. And so there weren't a lot of people in the bar. All I knew was that I needed a drink because, oh my goodness, what an afternoon I'd had so far. And so I thought, all right, and obviously the rest of these people in here think they need a drink. So I said, buy everybody, including you, a drink. Well, of course, because it was the not quite legal, not quite illegal bottle of Stoli from under the counter, he produces shot glasses, boom, 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 boom. Then very quietly changes the direction of the aerial for the television set to face west. So once we were all somewhat fortified by vodka, the questions started coming. What was that was on the TV just now? It was a commercial for, I think, a car. So I was explaining commercials, credit cards, and some of just the other stuff of Western life that you and I at that point probably were taking for granted. I thought, okay, that was interesting. What I did not know was that 6 weeks later, they would probably be crossing straight over into West Berlin saying, I can buy stuff now. And it works. And it's functional. And, oh, it comes in different sizes and colors and shapes. Nifty.
Yeah. No, incredible. And so when after you'd finish off that bottle of vodka, what did you do then?
Well, after finishing up there, I found my way back to Friedrichstrasse and got back through to West Berlin without a hitch. I mean, nothing. I thought it was as though the earlier part of the afternoon hadn't happened. Granted, when I got back to Zoe Station, I practically wanted to kiss the ground because I thought,
yeah,
okay, I'm just going to go ahead and buy myself a Diet Coke and a slice of pizza because all of a sudden life is good.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I understand you tried to cross over to see the 40th anniversary parade as well.
Oh, yes. I had rounded up a couple of friends and we intended to go over very early in the morning. So we all met up to go ahead and cross over, I think, at Checkpoint Charlie. That, like, really early that particular morning. It was like 7 o'clock in the morning. And trying to get, I'd say, 20-year-old kids up at that particular hour, particularly on a Saturday morning, after they'd probably been out all night, who, us partying in West Berlin? Never. We went ahead and met up, and there we were, saying, all right, we are here to go ahead and see what's going to happen over in East Berlin. Because we'd seen some of the rehearsals for it, I'd say, over, you know, a few times when we had been over in East Berlin. And basically these border guards were looking at us like, who are you kidding? Get out of here. So we were denied. And so we said, well, it's early in the morning. We may as well just go ahead and grab some breakfast. So we did that and just wandered around West Berlin the rest of the day. And, of course, we did not see any of what had happened over there. And it wasn't until I pulled that footage, I think it was last weekend, that I thought, wow. So that was what all of us missed. How incredible is that?
You mean the parade or the protests?
Yeah, both. Yeah. Because, of course, we knew that there was going to be a big military parade, and I wanted to see that because, of course, I'd never seen an Eastern Bloc-style military parade except on the television. I want to see this in real life. And then, of course, everything that happened, the protests that started later in the afternoon that were all over East Berlin, as well as Leipzig, Dresden, all of the usual places for the protests. And again, watching that footage that I found last week, that was just incredible. Because I thought, these are people who were my age then and who had just gotten fed up. I love it. And So, of course, as I said, the curious kid that I was, I thought, all right, so they've denied me entry. But then about a week and a half later, the entire American group went to East Germany as a group. And, you know, we were staying in Dresden, Leipzig, Erfurt, Weimar, and made a side trip to Dessau at the end.
Right. And on the on that trip, what were your guides like? Presumably you had official guides.
Oh, yes. They were also, I'd say, plus or minus our ages, you know, 19, 20 years old. And what was very cool about them is that on one hand, they were sticking to the party line, keeping us in the bubble. On the other hand, once we got back to the youth hostel, because they were all employed by the youth hostels, it was, hey, you know, where did you see a black market stall that sold this or that? Or when they realized, oh, Jillian, you have some good music with you. And I said, yes. What is it that you have? Oh, I have plenty of David Bowie. I have The Clash. I have Susie and the Banshees, you know. Virtually everything that was really good music still is. And they would go out, they would find a brick of blank tapes, and they'd say, can I roll some of your tapes? Oh, sure, go ahead. Because I thought the more the merrier. And what they were doing was they'd roll my tapes multiple times, take them back out to the black market, sell them on the black market. And so I've always, I have always, I'd say, prided myself on being one of the people who was introducing good music to the Eastern Bloc, because I'm thinking those tapes were probably bought by other Eastern European kids who were plus or minus my age. They were then retaped, and who knows? A couple of them may have made it all the way out to Vladivostok, for all I know.
Yeah, yeah. How did you find the rest of East Germany? What was Dresden like?
Dresden was fascinating because we actually went out to the area that had been carpet bombed by the Allies during the Second World War. We saw the ruins of Frauenkirche, yeah. And we saw some of the other, I'd say, ruins in that area that had not been repaired. And the other thing that totally spooked me about Dresden was that so much of that landscape, so many of the old buildings were blackened by coal dust because they used all that soft coal.
Yeah, lignite.
Yes, that horrific lignite coal, which, you know, permeated your clothes, permeated the air we breathed, because at that point, I think mid-October, it was already getting chilly at night. So anywhere we were was heated by a lignite coal furnace. And, you know, awful stuff. I remember that as we were traveling through there, every time I went to wash my face, we were given these flimsy whitewash cloths at the youth hostel. It was literally a layer of gray that came off your face after you'd been outside all day.
Right.
Yeah.
And what did they say to you about the bombing of Dresden? How was that portrayed to you?
Oh, the Allies were terrible people. Look at what they did. Look at what they had destroyed. And, you know, even though we are now friends with the Soviet Union, but look at what the English did. Look at what the Americans did. And so, yeah, it was, you were the bad guys. Okay, I can accept the fact that we did some serious damage. Yes, but, you know, we like your Western brothers and sisters, and we like you as people. We really do. It's just that we can't abide by your government.
Yeah. Yeah, and what was Leipzig like?
Leipzig was wonderful. I will never forget, we were in this museum in Leipzig because it had started to rain, and so a couple of other plans had been derailed. And that was, I think, the first place where I actually saw a Raphael painting. totally unexpected. I can't remember which one it was, but I recall looking at it and saying, oh my God, that's a Raphael. And that hit me over the head because I thought, and this is behind the Iron Curtain. It is basically imprisoned. Oh, this is so not right. Art is for everybody.
And I, well, surely anybody could go and see it in Leipzig.
Right, in Leipzig. But I thought getting into Leipzig, of course, because I was thinking not everybody can just wander into East Germany. And of course, the way that my head worked then, you know, much younger, I wasn't thinking in terms of, oh my goodness, yes, anybody can come and see this. That was more along the lines of, wait a minute, this art is here? However, I did manage to see, I think, a wonderful concert at the Gewandhaus, probably for next to nothing. And they have performed some absolutely beautiful music by Brahms. I thought, okay, I like the fact that the arts are incredibly subsidized, but if it's approved, I guess they approved this particular piece of music by Brahms.
Yeah, I'm not sure they would have approved of Susie and the Banshees.
No, I don't think they would have, but Susie was getting a fair amount of airplay.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And Erfurt, I'm not familiar with that city. What was that like?
Erfurt was wonderfully old. There were certain streets that we were walking down in Erfurt that I think dated back to the 15th century. And they were all made of stone, beautiful in Erfurt. I mean, it was a teeny weeny little town like that I think bordered on Weimar. And of course, when we were in Weimar, there wasn't, I'd say, a lot to see in Weimar then. From what I've heard, Weimar has come up in the world again. But of course, my very favorite was Dessau, because that was where the Dessau Bauhaus had been. And I don't think very many of the other American students had the interest I did in Bauhaus architecture. So there I was. It was Mecca. I thought, oh my God, I am actually at the Dessau Bauhaus. Because I've always had a love for Bauhaus architecture, simplicity and everything. And to be given this tour of the Dessau Bauhaus, and then to go into the basement where they had all of the prototypes of furniture. And I was standing there, I guess, salivating, saying, oh my goodness, all of this. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And while you were on this trip, did you meet any ordinary East Germans aside from your guides?
I made it a point to actually take a few walks on my own. I mean, that's just the type of person I am. It was, all right, you plunk me down in a city. Give me a map or give me an idea of where I have to go to get from A to B. And I'll probably be able to figure it out reasonably well. And I recall that we were at the youth hostel in Leipzig, and one of the other American students had developed a mad craving for American junk food, because trying to find American junk food in East Germany, best of luck to you, my friend. Best of luck. However, there were inter shops. And so I was given the task of go to the inter shop, because nobody else wanted to just wander around in Leipzig. And I thought, why not? Leipzig is a great city. I mean, the streets were teeming with people. It was obviously one of the cities that had been a seat of a whole bunch of stuff within the DDR. And I know that since unification, it's become a seat of counterculture. It's become a seat of music, art, etc., which does not surprise me in the least. And so I went ahead, grabbed up the American money and the West German money and the French money from everybody and said, all right, I'm going to the Ender Shop. Give me a list. So, of course, along the way, I thought, okay, I'm getting a little bit lost here. And so, yeah, found myself asking ordinary East Germans, "Well, is Ender Shop?" "Oh, okay, you know, just follow me. Just follow me. You're okay." And I thought, this is amusing. So that was how I managed to find the Ender Shop. And, yeah. And so then, of course, I get there and, you know, I'm picking up Coca-Cola, Diet Coke, potato chips, you name it. It was basically a convenience store run, but in East Germany. And I thought, this is hilarious.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was bizarre that, you know, there were these shops where only hard currency mm-hmm. could be accepted, and yet had items that ordinary East Germans would have never seen.
Oh, absolutely. That, and also finding out through my travels in East Germany that American cigarettes were currency. In that sort of, you know, old-fashioned, almost wartime sense of, okay, I remember getting a carton of Marlboros as well as a carton of Dunhills. I smoked Dunhills and so did one of the other girls. And we kept the Marlboros to use as currency. Because, of course, all the East Germans were like, oh, a good American cigarette? Marlboro was practically the gold standard. And so basically, if there was a little bit of bargaining to be done, particularly, say, if you were in a youth hostel bar, all you'd have to do is very quietly plunk down a packet of Marlboro cigarettes. And that was when the good booze came out from underneath the bar. That was when the bottle of Stoli was produced, or the bottle of Jack Daniels. I recall one night there was a bottle of Jack Daniels produced because one of the people in our group produced a packet of Marlboros, and all of a sudden it was, oh, okay, yes. Now that we have an agreement.
And did you see any evidence of dissent while you were in these other cities away from Berlin?
Oh, absolutely. The most, I'd say, visible sign of dissent throughout the other cities in East Germany was the black market. There were black market stalls, I'd say, in almost every single one of those city squares. In Dresden, the black market stalls. Leipzig, black market. So you would see evidence of the black market, and there were, and you know, occasionally cops were looking at it like, we're going to shut you down. But then on the other hand, they'd go around the block and you'd see them buying something from one of the black market stalls because it was something they wanted. It was music. It was a pair of Levi's jeans. It was decent makeup. Whatever it was something you couldn't get in ordinary life in East Germany.
Did you see any signs of protest in these cities as well?
I remember there was one night in Leipzig when, you know, it had already gotten dark and some of us had gone out just to take a little look around. I said, come on, be a little adventurous, let's go. And so they went ahead, went with me, and we found small sort of, I think, pub-style restaurant and bar. And we figured, okay, beer is beer. We're going to sit here. We're going to have a beer. And East German beer was, I guess you could call it mediocre. Wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible. And as we were coming away, because it was maybe about two blocks from the youth hostel, we heard in the background something that sounded like a bit of chanting, some protesting. We thought, oh, they're getting serious over here. All right. Of course, what we did not know was that less than 3 weeks later, wall would come down. Because, I mean, we were, yeah, it was like mid-October then, and we still had one more small trip into Poland to do. So we figured, okay, yeah, we still have to go to Poland. We'll be back in West Berlin for 3 or 4 days, long enough to wash the coal dust out of our clothes from this trip, only to probably get more in Poland.
Yeah. Yeah, I was that's what I was going to come on to, because you cross into Poland at the end of your trip around East Germany, don't you?
We crossed into Poland on October 26th. We went back to West Berlin, I think, somewhere around the 20th or 21st of October, which gave us 4 or 5 days just to wash the coal dust out, eat some decent food at our host families, because I have to say the food in East Germany was horrible. I mean, a typical dinner at youth hostel was a piece of unidentifiable whitish meat, golf ball-sized potatoes that were still hard but allegedly boiled, and cabbage. And I recall saying to one of my classmates, if I never see boiled cabbage again as long as I live, I will be perfectly happy. And breakfast. I have to tell the funny story of the propaganda oranges, because they had arranged some oranges in a very nice little pyramid one of the mornings. I think it was in Dresden. Very pretty. Of course, we all went to grab an orange because we were like, oh my goodness, fruit. We haven't seen fruit in days. What we did not know was that those were not juicing oranges or eating oranges. Now, granted, having grown up in Florida, you know, oranges. I found out that the oranges were from Cuba. They were not juicing oranges. They were not eating oranges. They were propaganda oranges. They were harder than a brick.
Did you try them? Did you eat any of it or not?
Well, I recall standing there peeling it. I thought, okay, this doesn't exactly feel like the oranges from back home. And then I bit into it, and it was so horribly sour. I mean, I looked like I had taken a huge bite out of a lemon. I remember pursing my lips and saying, ooh. That's not good. And that was when the joke about propaganda oranges started. So you can only imagine.
Well, if you enjoyed Gillian's story, I'm delighted to say there's more. We'll be talking to her in future episodes, and I'll just keep you in a state of suspense about what the contents of that might be. There's some photos that Gillian shared of her time in the GDR in the show notes, as well as some links to online video too. The show notes are at coldwarconversations.com/the word episode and the number 42. Don't forget, if you want more GDR podcast listening, GDR Radio is available via your podcast provider, and it's hosted by Anker Holst, our guest in episode 20, and Shane Whaley, the host of the Spybury podcast, and he was in episode 4. Just search for GDR Radio. If you like what you're listening to, do join our Facebook discussion group, where there's loads of Cold War information and further discussions with our guests. Just search Cold War Conversations in Facebook. And we're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. Lastly, if you like what you're hearing, do leave reviews on iTunes. It really helps me to get some great guests and helps spread the word around the podcast. Thank you very much for listening and supporting us. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.